Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Okay, I'm picking up this time with more of the proceedings of the 1971 Fourth International Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy, which was known as the Atoms for Development Conference, in contradistinction to the previous three, which had been known as Atoms for Peace. That was 1955, 58, and 64. What else am I going to say about this? Well, this is something from Volume 11, and the material in Volume 11 is Health, Physics, and Radiation Protection, Radioactive Waste Management, and the Environment and Public Acceptance. And I was last time reading from the expert panel discussion on the environment and public acceptance, and didn't quite get to the end, so I'm going to pick up where I left off, and then I'm going to go back and reread the discussion on the papers in Agenda Item 3.3, which is also the environment and public acceptance, and then I'm going to read some abstracts of papers in that section, because I had been doing that, and the episode where I was doing that didn't archive. So I think I can fit that all in. So picking up from where I left off last time, this is questions from the audience submitted to the moderator, D. Beninson of Argentina, and then answered by the panel. D. Beninson, moderator. Let me read out a further question. It is possible that one of the significant factors causing public concern about atomic energy is the lack of confidence in the independence of the regulatory authority, either because it is part of the development and promotional agency, or because its personnel have obvious close relationships with those in the promotional agencies or in industry. Would members of the panel comment on whether or not they agree with this observation, and if so, could they suggest any way of remedying the situation? Now, I have thoughts about this, but this isn't quite the place for them. M. Doucet. From experience in France of dealings with those opposed to the development of nuclear energy, it seems to me that the questioner's observation is correct. In other words, very often, people vigorously opposed to nuclear energy firmly believe that the majority of those entrusted with drawing up regulations, fixing limits, and laying down standards are also entrusted with promoting nuclear energy. I think they are mistaken, particularly if one considers the composition of the highest level organization in the regulatory sector, namely the International Commission on Radiological Protection. One only has to look at the background of its members and at its history to see that it has always been and still is basically composed of scientists who are more often than not independent of organizations having the task of promoting nuclear energy in the various countries. It is essentially made up of biologists, university teachers working in hospitals, doctors, and therapists who are primarily concerned with determining the action of radiation on cancerous tissue and who are therefore particularly qualified to ascertain and define quantitatively the action of radiation on tissues and organisms. D. Beninson, moderator. We now have another question that I am sure will start a substantial discussion. Several people have proposed, and a few countries have adopted, a standard based on the total man-rem per megawatt electrical contributed by nuclear power plants. Would panel members comment first on the reasonableness of this approach, and second on the practicability of translating such a standard into operating limits for an individual plant? H.J. Dunster. I dislike the concept of total man-ram dose because to me it implies too much faith in the linear relationship between dose and effect. If we add up man-rams, we imply that the total is in some way significant, regardless of how it is distributed among a greater or lesser number of people. So I think at the very best, a total man-ram concept of this sort must be a subsidiary aid. It can legitimately be applied, as it is in the government policy in the United Kingdom, to the total genetic dose to the country, but I do not think that is quite what the questioner had in mind. He asked about practicability. Given certain definitions, I do not think practicability is too difficult to achieve. The difficulty is essentially how to carry out the integration, and in particular how to limit the integration, because in general terms, the number of people increases faster than the dose decreases as you move away from the station, so that the integral is likely to rise in an almost meaningless way. In some way, therefore, the integral has to be cut off. Given that sort of definition, the approach is quite feasible, but I do not think it is particularly valuable. D. Beninson, moderator. The main point would be at what dose rate, for instance, would you cut off the integration? In connection with Agenda Item 3.3, there were suggestions based, for instance, on integration down to 5 millirems per year for the whole body, or 30 millirems for the thyroid. Of course, if you take different endpoints for your integration, the values obtained will be different. My personal view, however, unlike that of Mr. Dunster, is that this type of approach will be adopted in the future for dealing with population doses from nuclear power stations and other radiation sources. We now come to what will probably have to be the last question. What criteria would have to be met before one could justify altering the present dose limits upwards or downwards? J.T. Conway. I will give a non-technical answer to a technical question. There could be a raising of the dose limits under the following circumstances. If pollution and contamination studies in the conventional power field were to reveal that the biological and other effects are very bad, possibly much worse than the effects of radiation at the levels now set as limits, I could foresee an analysis being made and a justification put forward for raising the limits that have been applied to date. That point has not yet been reached, however, and if anything, we are being threatened with lower levels rather than the reverse. D. Beninson, moderator. The present system of dose limits has some internal inconsistencies, but this is certainly not what bothers either the public or the regulatory agencies. It is primarily for reasons of scientific correctness that these inconsistencies have to be ironed out. The present system of dose limits, as far as I can see, is a compromise between an earlier approach based on the concept of tolerance, something of the nature of a threshold, below which there is no risk, and above which there is a risk, and a new approach entailing a continuous relation between dose and effect. This relationship is assumed to be linear and without threshold, so if we are to use the risk coefficients deduced from epidemiological studies in a consistent way in all cases, the present system of dose limits may have to be changed. Against this, you have to balance the practicability of first measuring a given limit or a number associated with it and establishing whether or not there is consistency. In many cases, as the studies have indicated, values may go up. In other cases, they might be reduced. I think this matter is currently being considered by one or more of the international organizations and that recommendations will be forthcoming. We are very near our time limit. I was planning to summarize our discussion, but this is a very difficult task. We have touched on several aspects connected with power stations, with the environment, and with man. The emphasis of the contributions has been on the fact that, at least as far as radioactivity is concerned, the limiting factors are radiation doses in man and not the effects on the environment, and that the environment acts in this respect as a pathway to man. We have analyzed the pathway very briefly and have given some thought to the safety of plants and to how to inform the public. One point that emerged is the need for more extensive and deeper collaboration between the scientists and the public relations man in order to overcome a reaction which, in the moderator's view at least, is unscientific. Brother, you can say that again. But a friend who works in the private rocketry industry said to me once that he thought the whole idea of separating the regulator from the agency responsible for promotion was not smart because in order to be widely accepted and successful, it has to be safe. Anyway, now I'm going to read the discussion on agenda item 3.3, environmental effects and public acceptance. So these are by groups. So paper 160 from Canada, 671 from South Africa, 676 from Switzerland, 681 from France, 723 from USA. And the first question is from UA Israel. And U is as one letter, Yuri or something like that. It's Cyrillic, Russian, presumably. Could Mr. Marco tell us whether upper limits are set in Canada for the radiation doses released in nuclear power plant accidents? A.M. Marco. Yes, before approving the construction and operation of a nuclear power plant, the licensing authority in Canada carries out a safety analysis and issues guidelines to the designers for various types of accident, and the calculated doses for the different types of accident must be below the levels laid down in these guidelines. R.F. Foster. What is the reason for the thyroid rem per year limit? A.M. Marco. The thyroid rem per year is the integrated population dose and is stipulated by the licensing authority in addition to the individual thyroid dose for routine operations. Both limits must be observed by the operator. In areas of high population density, the population dose becomes more limiting than the individual dose. R.F. Foster. The last slide, shown by Mr. Tattersall in his presentation of paper P671, indicated that it might be desirable to limit iodine-131 releases of the order of 1 curie per year to a frequency of 10 to the minus third power events per year. This would seem to be a very slow release to consider in relation to an accident. Would Mr. Tattersall care to comment? J.O. Tattersall. The curve shown on the last slide is the result of the assumptions I outlined in the presentation. In this connection, let me repeat what I said during the presentation. We are not attempting to justify these assumptions at this stage. The slide showed incremental probabilities for 1 curie bandwidths, and our purpose in presenting it was mainly to draw attention to the assumptions underlying such curves that the full spectrum of accidents will arise. Because of this, there is a need to interpret the criteria in a practical manner, particularly when considering very large accidents. Since we were concerned principally with middle range and larger accidents, it was perhaps inappropriate to display a curve extending to the 1 curie region without corresponding discussion. When we come to formalize our release criteria, we shall perhaps consider that some of the assumptions appropriate to large accidents are too restrictive in the case of low releases. However, when establishing criteria for accidents in general, one has to take account of risks to site personnel as well as to the public at large. Our slide relates to iodine-131, and it should be remembered in this connection that a 1 curie release to the atmosphere as a result of a reactor accident could represent in many instances a very much larger release within the plant. Controlled operational releases would of course be limited by different criteria. V. Knapp. While I commend Mr. Tattersall's attempts to quantify the acceptable or tolerable risk as regards loss of human life in different activities, I would also understand any public reluctance to accept an argument which justifies the risk to human life in one activity on the grounds of the loss of life in another. Moreover, such an argument does not emphasize sufficiently the excellent safety record of nuclear power reactors. Unless society is willing to face the consequences of a power scarcity, and there are no signs of that, the alternative to nuclear power is power generated by burning fossil fuels, with the attendant loss of thousands of lives each year in coal mining. On the basis of the facts concerning fatalities in coal mining, as distinct from speculation regarding radiation effects, one can argue that the introduction of nuclear power generation reduces the loss of life and hence the overall risk to society. A study aimed at expressing this, in my opinion, stronger argument in quantitative terms might be of value. J.O. Tattersall. I think Mr. Knapp and I are largely in agreement. Our purpose in quantifying risks from other sources is to ensure that the safety status of nuclear power generation is as superior to that of other activities as we may wish it to be. I agree that a mere comparison of risk levels is not ideal, and it is for this reason that we are pursuing the development of cost-benefit analysis techniques. However, as I stated in my presentation, we have difficulty at present with comparative quantification of some of the factors involved in cost-benefit analyses, and so, until our techniques improve, we are leaning rather more heavily on a simple comparison of risks. A. Afshar Bakeshlu. There is mention in paper 676 of the fact that in future cooling towers will be required for nuclear power stations built on the rivers Aar and Rhine. How will this affect the cost of building nuclear power plants? P. Feutz. It will lead to an increase of about 10% in capital costs and about 8% in the cost per kilowatt hour. S. I. Auerbach. I should be interested to know from Mr. Renew, paper 681, whether there are provisions in French law enabling the individual or groups of individuals to contest, through established legal channels, the construction of a nuclear power plant on public safety or environmental grounds. J. Renew. Perhaps Monsieur Galvanet, a co-author of our paper, would care to answer this question. A. Galvanet. The decision to construct a nuclear power plant is taken by the Minister for Nuclear Power only after studying the findings of an interministerial committee on which the Ministry for Public Health and the Ministry for Environment are represented. UA Israel. Could Mr. Larson tell us to what extent radiation safety standards have changed during recent years in the United States of America? CE Larson. Since 1957, the radiation safety standards of the United States Atomic Energy Commission have been based on and consistent with the recommendations of the ICRP and the NCRP. That is to say, the exposure limit for an individual in the population should not exceed 500 millirem per year from all normal radiation sources, and the average per capita exposure limit for any population group should not exceed 170 millirem per year. In fact, of course, reactors have been operated with so much care that exposure doses to individuals and population groups have been far below these limits. In 1970, the Commission adopted rules which formally require, in keeping with ICRP recommendations, that the radioactivity levels of effluent be kept as low as practicable, and that waste handling equipment and procedures developed within the framework of established technology for this purpose be not only incorporated into plant designs, but also maintained and used. In 1971, moreover, the Commission provided numerical guidance on what should be considered as low as practicable, publishing a proposed rule which sets as a design goal for waste handling equipment an exposure limit for either gaseous or liquid effluent of 5 millirem for individuals both off-site and involved in plant operation. The proposed rule also provides for the consideration of action first by the licensee and then by the Commission to reduce effluent levels if the exposure limit is exceeded by a specified amount. Of course, the urgency of the need for power would have to be taken into account when such action is considered. G. Cantillon. Have estimates been made of the additional costs which will be incurred by nuclear power stations under construction if the proposed rule enters into force? C. Larson. Rough estimates have been made, and figures as high as $1 million have been mentioned. In the case of many stations under construction, however, provision has been made for the installation of some or most of the equipment which will be necessary for complying with the proposed new requirements. Where provision has not been made for the installation of the necessary equipment, the additional cost will depend largely on the state of construction reached and on the type of plant. The next group there is no discussion on. Discussion on papers 686, 685, 536. E. Iranzo Gonzalez. Could Mr. Alex Sachin tell us the minimum amounts of strontium-90, cesium-137, and other artificial radionuclides permitted in food sold on the Soviet market? I'm sure that's an error for maximum. R. M. Alexakin. In the Soviet Union, we find it convenient to base our standards on the recommendations of the International Commission on Radiological Protection. In addition, however, we do have our own statutory limits. Discussion on papers 684, 550, and 652. EAZ, that's EZZ. I fully agree with the excellent reasoning of Mr. Israel. The comparison between the hazards of conventional fuels and nuclear fuels is excellent. Usually, however, there are two points raised against this reasoning. Hazards from fossil fuels are generally local and never global, and they are not permanent. No genetic effects from fossil fuel waste have been recorded. I would be interested to hear Mr. Israel's comments on these points. UA Israel. As regards the first point, I would emphasize that, just like the non-gaseous waste products from conventional plants, most non-gaseous radioactive waste products entering the atmosphere remain there for only a few days at the most, the spread of radioactive products taking place mainly in the ground. With respect to the second point, we based our calculations on permissible concentrations, both of radioactive and of non-radioactive products, regardless of whether they produce genetic effects. F.D. Sauby. Estimates have been made in several countries of the population doses in man-rads per megawatt year deriving from nuclear power plants. Could Mr. Israel give the corresponding figures for nuclear power stations in the USSR? UA Israel. There are no such estimates in the paper. However, it is safe to say that the radioactivity situation in the vicinity of nuclear power stations in the Soviet Union is very satisfactory. R.M. Alexakin. I should like to ask Mr. Kuntz what, according to his data, were the doses received in Czechoslovakia during the period covered by the investigation reported in paper 550 from X-ray diagnostics, global fallout, and cosmic radiation? E. Kuntz. The per capita bone marrow dose from X-ray diagnostics tended to keep within the range 70 to 190 millirem in 1966. In the same year, the per capita gonad dose was 66 millirem, the genetically significant dose amounting to 37 millirem. The bone marrow dose to adults from fallout strontium-90 did not exceed on average 10 millirad per year, even during the years of highest fallout. These findings are based on dose calculations performed in accordance with the recommendations made by UNSCEAR in 1969. As regards the total dose from radioactive fallout following nuclear weapons tests, the UNSCEAR estimate probably applies to Czechoslovakia also. We have not yet attempted to calculate the dose for cosmic radiation. P. Vichitil. Have you assessed the doses to patients from radionuclides used in diagnosis and therapy? E. Kuntz. We are in the course of making such assessments, but we do not have any data available yet. A. K. Ganguly. In paper 652, Mr. Parker has evaluated the total exposure of humans to radiation arising out of the normal operation of all nuclear facilities. An incident involving a major release of activity to the environment, however, could increase the total exposure of humans by orders of magnitude. Has an assessment been made of the impact of such an incident? F. L. Parker. I agree with Mr. Ganguly. Unfortunately, however, time did not permit the analysis of accident conditions with the same degree of confidence as that with which one is able to carry out calculations for normal operation. P. Hublet. Could Mr. Parker tell us something about the International Register of Radioactive Waste Releases into the Environment, which is being discussed by the International Atomic Energy Agency and the World Health Organization? F. L. Parker. Perhaps Mr. Nishiwaki of the IAEA would care to answer this question. Why Nishiwaki? In 1958-59, the IAEA convened a panel of experts, which produced a report entitled Radioactive Waste Disposal into the Sea. One of the panel's recommendations was that the IAEA should maintain an adequate register of radioactive waste disposal into the sea. In August 1961, the Director General of the IAEA invited member states to provide information on disposals made in 1959 and 1960. In December 1967, a further letter was sent to all member states with a view to obtaining information on disposals into the sea. Replies were received from 22 countries, of which 8 stated that they had made such disposals, and a further 8 indicated that they would provide information about any disposals that they might make. The remaining replies were noncommittal. However, since the Symposium on Environmental Aspects of Nuclear Power Stations, held at UN headquarters in New York in August 1970, it has been suggested that the agency should establish an international register of significant releases of radioactive wastes from the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, not only into the sea, but also into the environment as a whole. In the light of the various suggestions and proposals made, a consultants' meeting on a register of releases of radioactive wastes into the environment was convened by the IAEA in cooperation with WHO. The meeting was held in Vienna from 28 to 30 July 1971. The consultants were of the opinion that the establishment within the United Nations system of an international register of releases of environmental pollutants, of which the register of radioactive releases might become a part, should be encouraged. They recommended that a register should be established by IAEA in cooperation with WHO for the collection on an international basis of information on radioactive waste releases and their locations. Based on these recommendations, possible procedures to be employed in establishing and maintaining such a register are now being discussed at the IAEA. If the IAEA's Board of Governors approves the establishment of such a register, the IAEA Secretariat will prepare detailed drafts for comments by the consultants. Okay, so that's the end of the panel discussion bit that I was reading earlier. And now I'm going to go back and reread some of these abstracts. I'm going to read all the ones that I think I had not read on a show that got archived before, and then I may go back and read a couple more of them. But paper 723, United States of America, The Energy Environment Equation, C.E. Larson, H.C. Brown, Jr., United States Atomic Energy Commission, Washington, D.C. This paper examines the crucial role of nuclear power in meeting the energy demands of the future, and also discusses the public acceptance problems that have been encountered in attempting to assess the environmental effects of nuclear power generation. Current estimates of nuclear power growth are examined in the context of projected requirements for increased electrical generating capacity, the gradual depletion of fossil fuel reserves, and the alternatives. The extent to which nuclear fuels will extend the world's energy stores for hundreds of years is examined and documented. Continued progress in solving some of the crucial social problems associated with urban societies throughout the world will be dependent to a large degree on the availability of electrical power. For example, the internal combustion engine, automobiles, now accounts for more than half the air pollution in the USA. This could be greatly reduced by the imaginative use of electrically powered transportation systems. The disposal and recycling of our billions of tons of waste material is another problem that will require massive amounts of electric power to solve. Data are presented to show that the breeder reactor will enhance the position of nuclear power from both an economic and an environmental standpoint. The breeder will ensure an unlimited source of reliable, low-cost power and will offer decided advantages in contributing to a cleaner environment. Environmental problems are viewed in a global context, and the point is developed that, since the Earth's finite supplies of air and fresh water are shared in common by all earthly inhabitants, pollution, which does not respect national boundaries, is properly a subject of international concern. Public attitudes toward the environmental effects of nuclear power derive from a syndrome of concurrent and coincidental phenomena. 1. The public's increasingly strident demand for a greater voice in the choice of any activity that impacts upon property values, cultural or recreational interests, or health. 2. The visible effects and seemingly inexorable trends of population crowding. 3. A new, generally healthy consciousness of the fact that a clean environment can no longer be taken for granted. 4. A growing awareness that the environment is everybody's problem, but seemingly no one's sole responsibility. 5. A recognition that environmental problems are global in character and are shared and affected by peoples everywhere. 6. A realization that blackouts and brownouts are not merely threats, but realities. And 7. A fear of radiation stemming from ignorance or misinformation on the part of some individuals. Public attitudes toward nuclear power are examined in the context of the above phenomena. Remedial actions are discussed in a critical and constructive manner. Paper 253 from Japan, Management of Radioactive Effluents from Nuclear Power Stations in Operation in Japan and Environmental Monitoring. M. Toyota, Tokyo Electric Power Company, S. Hamaguchi, Kansai Electric Power Company, C. Asada, Japan Atomic Power Company. The environmental problem is a matter of great concern in Japan. The development of nuclear power generation has proceeded under severe restrictions and control from its initial stages due to its possible effects on the environment. Since the general public has a growing interest in the overall environmental problem, and nuclear power generation is expected to increase sharply in future, studies on the environmental effects of the nuclear power industry are of great importance. At present, the following nuclear power plants, with an output of 1,323 megawatts electrical, are in operation in Japan. In addition to these, 9 reactors, total 5,800 megawatts electrical, are under construction by electric power companies in Japan. Careful attention has been paid to the design and operation of these plants so that the discharge of radioactive effluents from nuclear power stations can be maintained in accordance with the basic policy of keeping radioactivity levels as low as practicable. This paper deals with practical management of radioactive effluents from nuclear power stations, operational problems, actual results of radioactivity releases, and monitoring results in the environment. It also describes the new problem arising from the need for further reduction in the release of radioactive effluents to the environment, for instance, the disposal of the tremendous quantities of solid wastes resulting from solidification of liquid wastes, etc. The paper also touches on practical radiation control at power stations and matters desired in future development. Paper 087, Environmental Experience with Radioactive Effluents from Operating Nuclear Power Plants, B. Kahn, B. Schlein, and C. Weaver, Environmental Protection Agency, Cincinnati, Ohio. Although Schlein is from the U.S. Public Health Service. Radiological surveillance activities at the 8 nuclear power stations and the nuclear fuel reprocessing plant under routine commercial operation in the USA are described, and current results are summarized. At each facility, the operator or his contractor monitors the environment and presents findings in periodic reports to the USAEC. The appropriate state agency for public health or environmental protection also performs radiological measurements in the neighborhood of the plant, usually as part of a statewide monitoring program. The USAEC sponsors a program of independent measurements at several stations and periodic aerial radiation surveillance of the environment. New York University and the Essex Marine Laboratory are evaluating possible thermal and radiological effects of liquid effluents from two of these plants on aquatic life in the Hudson and Connecticut rivers, respectively. Studies to develop environmental surveillance guidelines have been conducted at operating facilities since 1967 by the Division of Environmental Radiation, formerly of the Public Health Service Bureau of Radiological Health. The field studies, which were initially undertaken at a fuel reprocessing plant, a boiling water reactor, and a pressurized water reactor that had been in operation for several years, have now been extended to include the newer and larger light water nuclear power stations. Concurrent measurements of individual radionuclides are made within the station, at points of waste discharge, in the immediate environment, and at points of possible human exposure. Thus, the magnitude of the source, the importance of paths to and through the environment, and the extent of radionuclide dispersion or concentration are indicated. Specific procedures have been suggested for collecting appropriate samples and measuring radiation and radionuclide concentrations in environmental media at the usual extremely low levels. The major observations have been the feasibility, given sufficiently sensitive techniques, of measuring directly the critical radiation exposure pathway and the desirability of basing environmental surveillance programs on the release rates of individual radionuclides measured at the source. Paper 085, Understanding the Dynamic Behavior of Radionuclides Released to the Environment. Auerbach, K. Nelson, Reichhold, Dunaway, and Booth of Oak Ridge National Laboratory. The environmental behavior of radionuclides released to aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems from both routine plant operations and tracer experiments at Oak Ridge National Laboratory has been studied by ecologists during the past 15 years. Two important aspects of these continuing studies are, 1, radionuclides used as tracers in the environment help to delineate complex ecological processes, and 2, radiolabels quantifying rate processes provide primary ecological information for developing dynamic models of radionuclide transfers to man. Systems analysis techniques are being used to simulate the environmental behavior of radionuclides. Chronic releases of small quantities of radionuclides to White Oak Lake and the Clinch River have provided a unique case study of the environmental behavior of several radionuclides. Radionuclides occurring regularly in organisms from White Oak Lake include strontium-90, cesium-137, cobalt-60, and tritium. Occasionally, ruthenium-106, antimony-125, and zinc-65 are found. Because of dilution, only strontium-90 and cesium-137 are found regularly in the Clinch River. Coupling of field and laboratory data on selected radionuclides in fish, aquatic insects, mollusks, and crustaceans provides the necessary parameters for dynamic models of radionuclide movements in aquatic ecosystems. Research in terrestrial ecosystems has emphasized the biogeochemical cycling of fission products in forest, grassland, and old field ecosystems. Radionuclide dynamics, cobalt-60, strontium-90, zirconium-niobium-95, ruthenium-106, cesium-137, and cerium-144 in natural plant communities have been followed where soil reaction products have formed. Plant translocation and food chain studies with sodium-22, potassium-42, calcium-45, strontium-85, rubidium-86, iodine-131, and cesium-137 have detailed pathways and fluxes of additional radionuclides in these ecosystems. Research has provided insight into the budgets and turnover times of major nutrient elements and potentially hazardous radionuclides in contrasting ecological systems. 15 years of environmental research at ORNL strongly suggests that the dose necessary to evoke an unequivocally detectable biological response is considerably greater than that resulting from maximum permissible concentrations in the environment. Paper 399, Environmental Exposure Due to Radionuclides in Gaseous and Liquid Effluents from Nuclear Power Plants in the Federal Republic of Germany. K. Arand, M. Roof, W. Shikarsky, and J. Schwibach. Nuclear power plants are increasingly being used to generate power in the Federal Republic of Germany. It is inevitable that certain residual radioactivity is released with the gaseous and liquid effluents to the environment, leading to some human radiation exposure. The public takes great interest in these problems, especially in densely populated areas. The operating experience available up to the present time in the first series of nuclear power plants has been that the situation regarding the disposal of radionuclides in gaseous and liquid effluents has been quite favorable. But because of the intensive utilization of soil and water, especially in areas of high population and industrial concentration, it must be established and guaranteed that the expected increase in nuclear power plants does not cause a change in this situation. The paper reports on operating experience with the nuclear power plants in the Federal Republic of Germany, and based upon this gives an analysis and an assessment of the expected environmental exposure by radionuclides in effluents from nuclear power plants. The expected increase in the number of nuclear power plants over the next decades will only cause a comparatively low radiation exposure of the population. Then from the Soviet Union, paper 457, Radioactivity of Ocean Waters and the Behavior of Certain Fission Products in the Ocean. All applications of nuclear power cause contamination of the environment with radioactive products, for the majority of which the ocean is the ultimate reservoir. In the interest of an up-to-date description of the artificial radioactivity of the ocean, the strontium-90 and cesium-137 contents were determined over the period 1965-1970 in the areas of greatest importance in this connection. The mean strontium-90 and cesium-137 concentrations, as well as the minimum and maximum values, were determined in the surface water of each of the areas investigated. Data were also obtained on the variation of concentration with time. In the Pacific, there was a tendency for concentrations to decrease, but in the Atlantic, the concentration over the period 1965-1970 remained at an approximately steady level, being normally 15 to 50 disintegrations per minute per 100 liters in latitude 70 degrees north and 30 to 150 disintegrations per minute per 100 liters in latitude 40 degrees north. The resorption of previously established high contamination areas was investigated in the Pacific Ocean. It was clearly shown that increased radioactive contamination at certain points was the result of nuclear waste disposal. Deep sea samples were taken from the oceans, and estimates were made of the content of strontium-90 and cesium-137 in the water. Approximate agreement was found between this estimate and radioactive fallout data. Deep currents of water were found with increased concentration of strontium-90 resulting from nuclear waste disposal. The behavior in the ocean of cerium, yttrium, and niobium isotopes was investigated. The particular effects of seawater on the state of the radionuclides were established. In particular, yttrium 91 is considerably subject to the effect of natural ligands, and in the layer of discontinuity is in the fully dissolved state. In other water samples, about 60% of the element goes into suspension. Biogenic and abiogenic processes for extracting radionuclides from seawater are examined. Abiogenic uptake and the fixing of radionuclides by suspension depends on the characteristics of the ocean's suspended matter. It is shown that iron, being a biogenic element, promotes the introduction of cerium-144, yttrium-91, and niobium-95 into plankton organisms and thus into the active biological cycle. The absorption of these nuclides from seawater by sediment in the Indian and Pacific Oceans is studied. Again from the United States, paper 086, The Biological Cost of Discharging Heat to Rivers, R.F. Foster, R.T. Jaski, W.L. Templeton, Pacific Northwest Laboratories. In view of the widespread conjecture that the addition of cooling water to rivers entails a substantial biological cost, comprehensive studies are being made, both under controlled laboratory conditions and on major rivers of the USA, to determine whether adverse effects actually occur. These studies include 1. Those carried out over a period of 25 years by the USAEC on the Columbia River in the Pacific Northwest, which is noted for salmon and is used to cool plutonium production reactors. 2. The Connecticut River in New England, noted for shad and used to cool a series of thermal power plants. And 3. The Tennessee River and its tributaries in the southeastern USA, noted for warm water game fish and heavily developed for both hydroelectric and thermal power. The potential for a significant biological cost at these operating sites has been uncommonly great because of the high temperatures of the effluents, the quantities of heat discharged, and the kinds of fish at risk. The studies embrace all the obvious ways that heat might directly affect anadromous fish, including upstream migration, spawning, egg development, growth and survival, downstream migration, entrainment of plankton, food organisms, and disease. Some laboratory and field experiments suggest that a very small percentage of the river fish may at times encounter unmixed effluent that could prove lethal, and that entrainment can briefly depress the abundance of zooplankton. Of much greater significance is that none of the field studies has thus far detected any heat-caused degradation of the stocks of desired fish, nor significant alteration of the quality of the ecosystems, except in the immediate vicinity of the discharges. Effects, if any, are of a much lower order than those produced by other factors that influence the abundance of fish and other aquatic life. Gee, Tin, have I put you off your food? Paper 451 from the Soviet Union. Methods of determining radionuclide content at or below MPC level in wastewater, environmental objects, and biological samples. MPC being, I believe, maximum permissible concentration. As a result of the appearance in the environment of man-made radionuclides, particularly those such as strontium-90, cesium-137, and plutonium-239, daily monitoring of their propagation has become necessary. The methods employed for this purpose must be rapid and sensitive. The authors briefly survey existing methods for the quantitative determination of these radionuclides and describe new methods for determining strontium-90 in the presence of yttrium-90. Cerium-144 and cesium-137 in salt-free and salt-containing aqueous solutions, which are quick, simple, and very sensitive, down to 0.1 of the MPC. These methods are based on the new, very effective principle of concentrating certain radioisotopes, whereby liquid-liquid extraction is combined with co-precipitation. The extractant used is an organophosphorus compound, the monoisooctyl ester of methylphosphonic acid. They give the formula here, it's quite complex looking, which in the presence of certain cations forms a solid organic phase, mixed organic salts in the form of flocculent deposits, which are readily separable from the aqueous solution. In this way, the particular radioisotopes can be almost completely, 98 to 100%, recovered from large volumes 1 to 20 liters of aqueous solutions in small amounts, 0.5 to 10 grams, of solid organic phase, the time taken being less than 30 minutes. However, it is possible to carry out a separate determination of these radioisotopes from the same... Moreover, it is possible to carry out a separate determination of these radioisotopes from the same sample. The combination of liquid-liquid extraction and co-precipitation has two advantages. First, a very high distribution coefficient, D approximately 10 to the 5th power, is attained for the three above-mentioned radioisotopes. Second, a solid organic phase is formed which is readily separable from the aqueous solution. Thanks to these two properties, a very high degree of concentration can be attained with these radioisotopes, factors of more than 10 to the 3rd power, with sufficiently complete and selective extraction. A condition has been formulated according to which at least 90% of the isotope being analyzed will be extracted to the organic phase with less than 9% of the interfering isotopes. Because of the simplicity and speed of the proposed methods, they can be used for systematic monitoring of effluents from separation facilities, surface and underground waters, atmospheric precipitations, etc., even under field conditions. The authors discuss the possibility of using the method where macrocontaminants are present and state the analytical conditions for determining strontium-90, cerium-144, and cesium-137 contents in seawater, foodstuffs, and various biological samples, urine, bone tissue, lung tissue, teeth. Strontium-90 can be determined satisfactorily in biological specimens even when below the MPC. A method is described for determining plutonium-239 based on liquid-liquid extraction with monoisooctal methylphosphonic acid and a mixture of isoamylphosphoric acids with a phase-volume ratio up to 100. This method is used for determining plutonium-239 content in lung tissue, bone tissue, surface waters, and other environmental objects. Another one from the Soviet Union, paper 686. The biological effect and behavior of radioactive fission products in agricultural chains. The paper considers the agricultural aspects of the radiation situation, which can arise through contamination of the environment by a mixture of nuclear fission products of different ages and products resulting from neutron activation of the soil. It quotes experimental data obtained in work carried out under natural conditions on experimental plots. Relationships are established between the density of the radioactive contamination produced on agricultural land by a fresh mixture of fission products, the accumulation of radionuclides in agricultural crops contaminated at different stages of their growth, the gamma doses and contact beta doses to plants, and the resulting radiation injury to the latter. Coefficients of proportionality are established between the intensity of precipitation, single event or continuous, of radioactive fission products and their concentration in crops. As a function of the composition of the radionuclide mixture, the stage of growth at the time of precipitation, and the period elapsing after the plants are contaminated. Field experiments were carried out with a view to deriving coefficients of proportionality relating the density of soil contamination by radioactive fission products, neutron activation products, and fissile materials to their degree of accumulation, as a function of the soil properties and the biological nature of the plants. The part played by soil and foliar uptake of radionuclides in the contamination of crops by radioactive fission products and neutron activation products is discussed. In other experiments, in which a fresh mixture of uranium-235 fission products was introduced into the organism of milch cows, a study was made of the accumulation and elimination of radionuclides of iodine, tellurium, molybdenum, barium, etc., and coefficients were obtained for the proportionality between the uptake of the mixture by the animal organism and the radionuclide content of the animal products. A relationship was established between the uptake of a mixture of fission products by cows via the feed, the dose burdens to the critical organs, and the degree of radiation injury. The results given in the paper are used to calculate the lowest density of radioactive contamination of agricultural crops, meadows, and pastures by radioactive fission products of different ages, which will cause radiation injury to pasture animals and plants. Paper 685. Migration of radionuclides in forests and the effect of ionizing radiations on tree plantations. The paper considers the initial distribution and subsequent migration of the main radioactive fission fragments, strontium-90, zirconium-95, cesium-137, and cerium-144, in tree plantations under conditions of single and continuous precipitations of radionuclides from the atmosphere. Quantitative parameters are estimated to describe the interaction of the precipitated aerosols with forest vegetation and the vertical migration of radionuclides in the forest cenosis. Coefficients for the initial retention of radionuclides by the tree crowns, the radionuclide half-loss period for the forest canopy, the rate of vertical migration of radionuclides in the forest soil profile, and the uptake of radionuclides by forest vegetation and soil. Quantitative relations are established between the content of radionuclides in the different wood plant components and the radiation doses they receive. It is shown that when a mixture of radioactive fission products is precipitated from the atmosphere, the main part of the absorbed dose to the meristem tissues of wood plants is due to beta radiation. A description is given of the radioecological effects of irradiation of a forest by precipitated aerosols, whether due directly to the irradiation or taking the form of secondary changes resulting from radiation damage to the biogeocenotic relationship between the various components of the forest cenosis. Changes in forest growth and development, in the species structure of plantations and in the soil cover, in the forest microclimate, etc. The paper investigates the possibility of recovery of a forest suffering from the effects of ionizing radiations with an increased content of long-lived radionuclides in the soil. Paper 536. Nuclear Operations in Rural India and the Conservation of the Aquatic Environment. P.R. Kamath, I.S. Bhatt, A.K. Ganguly, Health Physics Division, Vava Atomic Research Center, Trombay. There is great enthusiasm for nuclear power in the less developed but populated regions in India. There exists, at the same time, a genuine concern about the possible deleterious effects accruing from releases of radioactivity. Proper site selection and careful safety evaluations are a prerequisite of a nuclear project. Safety criteria exist to ensure that the population is not exposed above the permissible levels and that the environment is not adversely affected. Development of nuclear resources in the widely scattered operational sites in the country also pose problems of disposal of effluents. There are sulfates, manganese, and radium from uranium oil ore milling and tailings disposal, nitrates, fluorides, and ammonium salts from fresh fuel manufacture, and fission products from fuel reprocessing. The enforcement of controlled releases is checked by the Site Environmental Survey Laboratory, working independently of the operating organization. Field investigations are conducted to determine dilution, dispersion, and ecological reconcentration of pollutants and to determine safe recipient capacity of an environment. Studies made in India have shown that local conditions, for example dietary intake, may differ markedly from results obtained in national surveys. Details are presented of particular studies on the aquatic media around the Vava Atomic Research Center, the Tarapur Atomic Power Station, and the Uranium Corporation of India Limited at Jadugada, and a discussion is given on water problems of the Rajasthan Atomic Power Station and the nuclear fuel complex Hyderabad, both of which are due to enter operation in 1971. The part played by the Environmental Survey Laboratory in surveillance and publication of information is outlined. Paper 684 from the Soviet Union. Prospects for extensive peaceful utilization of atomic energy without radiation risk to the population. Extensive development of the peaceful uses of atomic energy may result in the release of small amounts of radioactive products into the environment. Such releases must be strictly controlled in accordance with ICRP regulations and national standards for radiation safety of the population. Calculations are performed to show that the amount of air needed to dilute to the maximum permissible concentration, the various isotopes and impurities which are formed during operation of power plants using nuclear and chemical fuels. It is shown that for each unit of energy obtained through fission reactions in atomic power stations, the amount of air required to dilute such releases to the permissible concentrations is at least 10 to the third to 10 to the fourth power times less than that required for power stations operating on conventional fuels. Estimates are given of possible contamination levels for wide areas extending over countries and continents. If it is assumed that by the year 2000, nuclear plants will be generating between 3 and 5 terawatts of electricity, The result, even if realistic allowance is made for the possibility of emergency situations, will be average concentrations less than 1% of the MPC with uniform mixing in the lower reaches of the Earth's atmosphere. If chemical fuels were employed, the MPC would be exceeded by a factor of approximately 10. Consequently, the development of atomic power ensures that the environment will be maintained sufficiently pure. More than that, the replacement of conventionally generated power by nuclear power will reduce contamination of the environment by toxic substances and return the environment to a healthier state. Paper 550. Studies of the exposure of the population in Czechoslovakia to ionizing radiation. E. Kunz, Z. Brechik, D. Brechikova, and J. Chishki, Department of Radiation Hygiene, Institute of Hygiene and Epidemiology, Prague. A radiation protection system appropriate to actual risks requires a knowledge or an estimate of exposure of population groups to different sources of radiation. Studies have shown that X-ray diagnostics are the predominant source of radiation exposure in Czechoslovakia. In 1966, the genetically significant dose amounted to 37 millirads, the per capita bone marrow dose being probably within 70 to 190 millirad. Practically every citizen is exposed, individual doses differing considerably. To estimate exposure from radioactive fallout, a system was sought by which food contamination by strontium-90 and cesium-137 could be followed. The chosen system comprised a follow-up of milk on a national scale and analysis of selected foodstuffs in selected localities. Contamination of milk was found not to be an adequate indicator of contamination of food as a whole. Representative data on exposure were gained by long-term follow-up of strontium-90 in human bones. Mean bone doses did not exceed several millirads per year, the range of values observed being comparatively narrow. The ratio of strontium-90 concentrations in compact and spongious bone required for data evaluation depends significantly upon age and changes with time. Systematic monitoring of external exposure and selective determination of internal contamination in professionally exposed persons have disclosed low mean values. Data show that risk of higher exposure in different types of work with radiation sources varies with the work. The effect of such work on the general population burden is small, though special groups might be affected to a greater extent. A radiation protection system must comprise differentiated monitoring of workers' exposure and studies of the consequences of specified programs on population exposure. Progress toward dose reduction in medical procedures and the influence of new techniques are both necessary to reduce medical exposure. These various studies require administrative coordination. In Czechoslovakia, the participation of the public health authorities has played an important role. And then the final paper from the World Health Organization and International Atomic Energy Agency, Public Health Implications of Radioactive Waste Releases, paper 652. The public health impact of the environmental aspects of peaceful uses of atomic energy is particularly difficult to evaluate because of the small amounts of activity in the environment due to such uses. The human dosages due to present usage are low, often masked by dosages due to naturally occurring radioactive material and fallout from nuclear weapons testing, and are frequently determined as an upper limit only. In only a few cases have the doses been determined, and in even fewer cases have the data been published for a power reactor installation alone. A determination of the total dosage and effects on the environment requires knowledge of the radioactive materials released from all operations of the nuclear industry. In addition, knowledge is required of the form of the material released, its mode of travel, and the quantity ingested or inhaled. These conditions obviously cannot be met for most cases. Consequently, a number of assumptions have been made in order to calculate on a conservative basis the expected dosages for the world population. Since no two environmental situations are quite alike, nor are the responses to the perturbations in the normal environment, the results should not be assumed to fit any one site precisely. The assumptions are varied in order to test the sensitivity of the resulting dosages to changes. The major assumption is that the dose is integrated for populations over entire regions and around plants to a distance where the dose is less than 0.01% of the maximum permissible dose. The results of the computations show that at the present time, peaceful uses of atomic energy have had little effect on the health of man and on his environment. In the future, however, more effective removal and containment will be required to keep human dosages to acceptable levels. Okay, you have been listening to Hear Now the Words on AnonRadio.net, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, United States of America, and I may well read them out on the air. If you'd like to support my efforts, patreon.com/Publius_reads or paypal.me/PrometheusLives. Those are two ways. And coming up in about 10 seconds is DJ Damaru with Evolution Revolution. And we hope you continue to enjoy the programming selections here on AnonRadio.net.